our last episode, we identified that representational analysis matters because this work uncovers symbols that reveal the ideology the producer wants the audience to believe. Additionally, these ideologies also give light to the political and societal power structures which allow and support the text to exist. In this episode, we continue that conversation, looking at why institutions care about the representation in the media, taking time to focus on the police specifically. This episode will highlight why a police force cares about the media representation and how it is an effective tool in public relations, even when the police themselves aren't the producers of a text, but simply feature in them. Salutations, listener. Welcome to a new episode of A Culture Made of Algorithms. My name is Omar Aline, and this podcast takes a look at our media consumption, the culture produces, and societies left behind. Now, this episode forms a second of a three-part multi-series looking at representation. So if you missed the last episode, I welcome you to pause this episode, find the one in this series which should be titled Why Care About Semiotic Representation, and give that a listen, because this episode will be relying on the conclusions made in that episode to make the foundations of this one. And I'll know if you did it because the analytics will tell me. And speaking of analytics, we're going to be relying on quite a few of them today as we look at the who cares about media representation, namely organisations and bodies that work under the presumption of public interest, aka those who benefit from what might be considered a state-sponsored propaganda model. And I recognise that this might rustle a few feathers, but propaganda, as defined by Harold Laswell, is the expression of opinions or actions carried out deliberately by individuals or groups with a view to influencing the opinions or actions of either individuals or groups for predetermined ends and through psychological manipulations, as described by Jax Ilu in his 1973 essay, Propaganda, the Formation of Men's Attitudes. Hopefully then, you can see that by focusing on propaganda, we make the next logical step in having a conversation about hegemonic power and how representation plays a part in forming public opinion on people, places, and things, and either upholding or dismantling ideological, cultural status quos. Therefore, when I say state-sponsored propaganda, I say it meaning that this is beyond purely political messaging. In fact, state-sponsored propaganda is far more widespread and nefarious than existing just within political texts endorsing the wins of totalitarian regimes. It exists in capitalist, democratic, and free-speaking, free-thinking societies, running the very marketplace of ideas it pretends to have a stall at. But because this will be a conversation about police and policing, particularly in the context of the UK and in Hollywood television and film, I hope to be avoiding the explicitly political examples that might come to mind when talking about the state attempting to curry ideological public support for either themselves, a policy, or party. Instead, I want to show you, or at least tell you, about why the police as a machine of the state benefits from media representations that share an ideology that the police should be trusted, and in turn, how this messaging has had an impact on us. So with enough pre-episodic rambling being invested, I invite you to discuss with me about the power of copaganda. Cultural critic Justin Charity in The Ringer defines copaganda as a term coined to describe media efforts that flatter police officers and spares them from critical coverage. It's something we see in videos where the police hand out free food, or edited clips where they save someone from drowning, or even sing and dance to a song charting highly on Billboard. In the UK, we might rarely see these types of video being conducted by officers of our respective police forces, and if we do, it's rare to be shared by a news outlet rather than the police themselves. But does it have an effect on Britons? Well, thankfully, because it's usually a police communication outlet sharing any sort of non-crime related footage, it's harder to back with any sort of evidence. However, when you look at recent polling data, there's certainly a trend, or at least a relationship. So let me share with you what I found. When surveyed in December 2019, 77% of people surveyed by YouGov thought that the police were doing a good job. It's a 1% increase from 2015, when the HMICFRS, the Inspectorate of Constabulary and Fire and Rescue Services, requested Ipsos Mori to survey more than 25,000 Britons across England and Wales about their opinions on the police. Yet in 2015, the same year the original survey was conducted, and despite more than 76% of people having a positive opinion of the police, More than 96% of police officers leaving the force cited that the way the police were treated as a whole was a reason for their imminent departure. It paints an image of the detachment between the general public and the police, one which places people who are supposed to liaise with the community at odds with the community's opinion. So I looked a little deeper, hoping to find why thinking highly of the police was not translating into good treatment of the police. And this is what I found. So 2015, when surveyed by Ipsos Mori, 31% of 25,000 people had been in contact with the police in the last year. Of those 25,000 people, so not limited to those who had been in contact with the police in the past year, 32% of people spoke highly of the police, with 41% believing that the police were dealing with crime and antisocial behaviour that mattered to them. It's interesting that even though the police will deal with crime that the public cares about, the public still won't speak highly of the police. So there must be more to it than simply putting people behind bars that the public cares about. But right off the bat, we can see that more people speak highly of the police than those who had been in contact with them directly in the past 365 days. And if that 41% is translated to the university grading system, the police were getting a passing grade by the public in dealing with issues that mattered to them. Yet I was still unsatisfied. The two outcomes, one reached by the police and the other reached to by the public, still didn't match up. So I put on my capping for the state hat on and dug a little deeper into the whys behind the public opinion. Now, what I found was that when identifying why people might like the police, Ipsos Mori understand that the police need to be seen, but also active in preventing crime, responding to and investigating crime. And here is what they found. So using their 2015 findings, Ipsos Mori asked 25,000 people in England and Wales if they believed the police in their local area were effective at reducing crime. 39% responded with a positive effective score, and in 2017, the number had decreased to 34%. In 2015, when asked if the police were effective in their local area at preventing offending, 32% responded with the effective score, and this figure fell to 30% in 2016 and 29% in 2017, respectively. In 2015, when asked if the police in their local area had been effective at investigating offences, 37% responded with a positive score, which once again fell to 34% in 2016 and remained the same in 2017. Ipsos Mori also found that during this period, only 33% of people believed the police were very effective when responding to calls made by members of the public. Most interestingly from this report was that only 28% of respondents felt well informed about what the police in their local area were doing, and 67% of respondents had not interacted with police in the last year. For those that did interact with the police as a victim of a crime, only 38% of people felt satisfied with the thoroughness of any investigation, and less than half felt safer after reporting the crime. So far, what we can see here is that a very limited number of people are reporting the highest positive score in their opinion of the police's effectiveness, and that's in relation to any sort of policing in their local area. Yet still, when asked, 76% of people were satisfied with policing generally. So how did they come to this conclusion? Well, thankfully, this is also where we begin to make a tentative link to this podcast about media consumption. Because when asked in that 2015 survey, where did the respondents see or hear about the work being conducted by the Inspectorate Constabulary in the past 12 months, more than 71% of the responses came through media channels, whether that was online and social media posts, had heard about their work on the radio, read about it in a local or national newspaper, or seen them on the television. At 71%, it's more than three times the number of people who had interacted with the police personally at 29%. Now even I can see that 71% is close to but is not actually 76%. And claiming that all 71% of the media consumption responses were positive would be foolhardy. In fact, claiming that only a fraction of the physically contacted 29% would be foolish as well. Yet I can see that there is a relationship. A relationship between the media representations of the police and the public perceptions of the police that has resulted in a high level of public satisfaction with the police, even though reports of actual policing aren't amazing. And high satisfaction reports aren't just limited to the HMI CFRS request fulfilled by Ipsos Mori either, as the Home Office in 2017 reported that two-thirds of the public believed that the police were doing a good or excellent job based on the Independent Crime Survey for England and Wales in March 2017. And between 2019 and today, The lowest polled point was February 2020, where only 67% of the public believed that the police were doing a good job. Coincidentally, the same month when it was announced that only 7.1% of crimes in England and Wales resulted in a suspect being charged. 7.1% is a figure that does throw me, because in both fictional and documentary representations of the police forces and their investigation units, their victories seem to be 100%. And I use the word seem deliberately here, because when you consider shows revolving around cold cases or mysterious serial killers, that semiotic analysis machine that we explained the workings of in the last episode begin to go into overdrive. Because now I'm watching and reflecting on media texts with police in them, realizing that the narrative of these texts are implying that the police only failed to catch these super criminals because the criminal was remarkable, superhuman, almost because they avoided the inevitable mistake that we're told every criminal, from the shoplifter to the serial killer, seems to make. But what is the traditional narrative? Well, when looking at police dramas such as Lupin, CSI or Poirot, and factual television that centres the police such as Crime Watch, Cops or Police Interceptors, what I'm inferring is that police work is full of victories and prosecutorial wins that happen every day. These texts hold the ideology that the police are right consistently and thus should be trusted, both as individuals on the force but as an entire force too. It's a narrative that really comes to a head in those maverick cop movies such as the Dirty Harry series with Clint Eastwood, Takers with Matt Dillon, and Den of Thieves with Gerard Butler. I'm even tempted to include Mindhunters here, because in these police texts, what is shown is why we as the public must believe in both the individual and the force. Because when the force inevitably fails to catch the super criminal we hinted at earlier, it takes the rogue agent who is willing to work outside of the force's limitations to get a result for the greater good that is public safety. It's not an ideology limited to the fictional world of Hollywood either, as in 2015, when responding to the claim that only 1 in 10 officers would recommend a job, policing minister Mike Penning directly cited that cutting red tape and giving officers the discretion to use their professional judgment were helpful policies for officers. Additionally, when surveyed again 5 years later in June 2020, 55% of police officers in England and Wales believed that human rights laws were bad for justice. It means that when a text is telling us that we should trust the police, even ones that break the system designed to keep them in check, it's not an entirely fictionalized belief that is used to embellish a cop drama. Instead, it seems to be a transmitted ideology supported by agents of the institution itself. Both the fictional text and the factual human being who wakes up each day and puts on uniform believe it's about the individual officers who catch a criminal, not the system of laws that require them to be caught or a force that employs them. Justice here, then, transcends just laws. It's an ideology rewarded by the outcomes of these texts too, when the film or episode ends at the point where the villain of the narrative is caught. Only caught, mind you, because the cop who circumvented the system took them down. So we, as the audience, have just been told to believe in the boys in blue because they will get the job done. We're also being told that a police officer hot for justice is greater than what the law will do for us, the public, a good, even if the law doesn't allow them to. It's potentially why that 7.2% figure shocked me. It's also potentially why it shocked so many other people too. Because when we revisit the Isbos Mori findings and connect the dots, the conclusion is this. People understand the police aren't effective in their role and believe they aren't working in their best interest, but still believe the police are good and useful. It means that the public have a warped perception of the police. It's warped because so much of our media represents the police in a light so positive that our reality seems perverse and distorted in comparison to the representation. Yet again, making a case for Baudrillard's hyper-reality perspective. It's a fact compounded when so few of us have regular contact with the police officers in person or hear their correspondence. And police forces are aware about how effective and persuasive their media representations are. Back in May 22nd, during the height of the 2020 COVID-19 restrictions in the UK, the Metropolitan Police Service released a 2-minute promotional clip on their Twitter account that showed a dramatised version of the Met in the line of duty before ending with a thank you message to the NHS frontline staff. The video, which technically has a message that has nothing to do with the police, is positively responded with people thanking the Metropolitan Police Force directly. It turned out to be an interesting time to reinforce the positive representation of the police in the media too, as this release would share the same week as the viral arrest of a black ambulance driver in London and the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. In both cases, conversations around race, racialized policing, and police brutality in both the United States and the UK would be reignited too, culminating in the claim that the police force should be defunded. It also culminated in a very interesting conversation where a lot of people recognised the statistics but chose to ignore them because they believed the police were doing a greater good. Now, to prevent being accused of moving the goalposts, I'll make a brief case on behalf of the fictional text too. Because fictional texts do like to celebrate the force catching an officer gone rogue as well. In fact, some examples I cited earlier have entire plot points revolving around corruption. Takers, a film that is approaching 2 hours in length, manages to fit in narratives about the bumbling force, the exceptional cop, and the force catching a corrupt cop narrative all within its 1 hour, 47 minute runtime. Training Day with Denzel Washington is another film where the virtues of the exceptional cop manage to outdo the corrupt one, and British television show Line of Duty is premised on the idea of an anti-corruption unit. It places critics of the force in a nearly impossible position, because if the critique is based on the statistics of the effectiveness of the force, so few people have interacted with the police that it is hard to find someone else who agrees. Meanwhile, because the majority of the public is only interacting with the police in one-sided, quasi-interactive mediums detached from the actual effects of active or inactive policing, their perspective is exceptionally positive. And when we look at these media texts in closer detail, they tell us that the police not only win more often than they do in real life, but if we ever find them losing, it's because a good cop was caught behind red tape. Meanwhile, if your critique is based in personal experiences, one which show people on the receiving end of negative police interactions, your critique is hemmed in from being allowed to make a wider comment about the force as a whole, because once again, those quasi-interactive texts tell us that bad police are few and far between, with the force being trusted and effective at catching their rogue agents. It essentially argues that what you experienced was impossible. This is why organisations of the state care about media representation, because the truth is, so few citizens of the state interact with the tools of the state in any meaningful way. It's a premise that I can apply to the armed forces, financial systems, law and justice systems, arbitration, driving enforcement, education, and naturally politics. It means that media representations, whether they are fictional or factual, filling the gaps of our expectations in a way that would be impossible for interpersonal communication between people and the state to exist. It also benefits from these opportunities because media producers are likely to share an ideology with the audience that benefits them as the hegemonic political power. Because believing the police should be trusted is not bucking the status quo, it is the status quo. So what are the media consumptive practices, the cultures they produce, and what is the society left behind, as discussed in the second part of the mini-series? Well, like the last episode, we still consume media that contains an ideology. And because ideologies must be shared by both the producer and audience in order to be accepted, we can see that an audience preconditioned to be supportive of the police is accepting pro-police media texts. So when both fictional and factual media tells the public to trust the police, regardless as to whether or not it is effective or legal, it creates a cultural consensus where the public is willing to tackle dissent, no matter how emotional or well-informed it is. It means that days where the small town force, made up of valuable interpersonal connections, just isn't relevant or even necessary anymore. Public communications can be done on the mass level rather than the micro. So, this is all for this week. As always, there will be questions on my Twitter and Instagram pages, and I welcome you to take part in them. You can find the poll on Twitter if you follow at ACMOAPod, and the poll on Instagram if you follow me at Omar Aline. Now, the questions for this week will be as follows. Do you enjoy police dramas? Have you found police dramas informing you about real-life policing? Do you prefer watching The Maverick Cop or the by-the-book police force? So yeah, this last one, I thought I'd have a little bit of fun with it because I thought this was a bit of an intense episode that nobody really asked for. So I thought I'd ask this. You've just seen your best friend appear on Crime Watch. They're wanted. The reward for handing them in is £10,000.
do you take it?
To take part, follow me on Twitter as @ACMOAPod or follow me on Instagram as @OmarAline. If you want to connect, I'm on Vero too as @OmarAline, and you can email the pod to aculturemadeofalgorithms@gmail.com. I do look forward to hearing from you. In this next episode, we will close this mini-series by looking at the people who are impacted by representation analysis in an episode that looks at our media and their archetypes, stereotypes, and genre types that have filtrated into our cultural conversations. But until then, keep consuming, think about the culture you're a part of, and society you're leaving behind. Stay safe.